Welcome to Keeping Up. This is week 21. This is Clay, the Weird Chief Complaint Smith.
This is Jim. I'm hoping to get Jake Peavy traded to the Cardinals Fichtel.
Outstanding.
Just trying to get the bandwagon started.
This is a CME offering from the Vanderbilt School of Medicine, and on your screen should be the full CME disclosure statement. You need to read this. It's both on your screen right now, and it's also on our website. Go to our website, keepingupinem.com, and click on the tab that says Get Your CME. Now, you have to register in order to do this, and those that register can log in and get all the access to your CME credit and also to all the written summaries that we have also on screen during the podcast. All the articles will be hyperlinked directly either to the article that's free full text or at least to the abstract that's found in Medline. So you can also find these hyperlinks on the written summaries. So go to our website today, keepingupinem.com, and we hope you enjoy this week's podcast, This Week in Journals. So let's start out with Plint et al. This is epinephrine and dexamethasone in children with bronchiolitis in New England Journal last week. Now the study question, does inhaled epinephrine and or high-dose dexamethasone affect outcome with bronchiolitis? This was a randomized double-blinded trial with about 200 patients in one of four groups. There was a combined epinephrine inhaled dexamethasone PO group, epinephrine alone, dexamethasone alone, or both placebo. For the primary outcome of hospitalization at 7 days, there was a 9% decrease in hospitalization in the combined inhaled epinephrine and PO dexamethasone group. Number needed to treat was only 11. Epinephrine was, again, given by nebulization, and dexamethasone was super high dose, 1 milligram per kilogram on day 1 and 0.6 milligrams per kilogram for 4 days thereafter. Here are the limitations. Given the multiple comparisons done in this study, statistical techniques were used to adjust since there was an unexpected synergy between epinephrine and dexamethasone. And to simplify, the placebo group had to be used twice, so there are some statistical techniques that were used, and unfortunately, the results did not reach statistical significance with this adjustment for multiple comparisons. The p-value was 0.07. Application to practice, it does appear that epinephrine and dexamethasone have some sort of combined synergy that improves outcome in bronchiolitis, possibly. The problem with this study is this is crazy high-dose dexamethasone. I'm really not willing to embrace this yet, given the adjusted numbers and my unwillingness to give infants as young as 6 weeks, because it was 6 weeks to 12 months in this study, such high-dose steroids. This would be the equivalent on day one of giving 10 milligrams per kilogram of prednisone.
But given whopping doses of dexamethasone, can't possibly be the right answer for this.
What's it going to do with developmental outcomes in these kids? There's no long-term data to say that this is safe yet. I'm not on this bandwagon yet.
Agree. All right, next up is Ebrahimi et al. Outcomes following preoperative clopidogrel administration in patients with acute coronary syndromes undergoing coronary artery bypass surgery. The ACUITY trial, published in the Journal of American College of Cardiology, May 26, 2009. Context, what really is the impact and safety of clopidogrel given to non-ST elevation acute coronary syndrome patients who subsequently underwent CABG after the initial catheterization? This is a subgroup analysis of the ACUITY trial yielded 1,539 patients that underwent CABG. Of these, a little bit over half, 51%, received clopidogrel prior to CABG. Primary results for the clopidogrel exposed group were significantly reduced rates of composite ischemia and myocardial ischemia with comparable pre- and post-CABG bleeding. However, when the clopidogrel exposed group was analyzed based on the time from the last dose to CABG, the group that received clopidogrel within 5 days of CABG did have increased rates of ischemia and bleeding when compared to that group that allowed for the 5-day washout, as recommended by the American College of Chest Physicians. Limitations of this study, this is a subgroup analysis that did not blind the treating physicians to the presence of clopidogrel, and also the group exposed to clopidogrel taking a CABG within 5 days probably represents a higher risk group. Now, some data regarding the time of last dose is also lacking, which kind of throws this whole comparison of less than 5 days and over 5 days kind of up in the air. Now, the application to practice is give clopidogrel. Patient outcomes are better with similar bleeding rates for those patients requiring CABG, albeit a very small percentage will actually need to go to CABG after angiography. And it does reduce composite ischemia.
I bet old Bill Clinton wished this study would have been published when he was sitting in the hospital waiting for his bypass.
Exactly.
Next up is Rathor et al., Association of Door-to-Balloon Time and Mortality in Patients Admitted to the Hospital with ST Elevation Myocardial Infarction, a national cohort study in British Medical Journal just this week. The question is there mortality benefit of door-to-balloon time if it's less than 90 minutes? Of course, the recommended across-the-board standard is get them to the cath lab, door-to-balloon, less than 90 minutes. Now, the results are, in these 43,801 patients that were studied in this registry database from the American College of Cardiology, the patients included were all STEMI patients and all received PCI. Primary outcome was relationship of door-to-balloon on in-hospital mortality. What they found is that the longer the delay to balloon time, the greater the mortality. If you presented and had door-to-balloon of 30 minutes, which is stellar, then 3% mortality. Compare that to 90 minutes, where it was 4.3% mortality. Compare that to 180 minutes, 8.4% mortality. And the graph just goes up. The limitations, it's unclear the true ischemia time because this was by patient report and late mortality effects are not known in this study. The application would be D2B ASAP.
Exactly. Next up is Todd and Tapson, Thrombolytic Therapy for Acute Pulmonary Embolism, published in Chest in May 2009. Really, what is the current best evidence for thrombolytic therapy in acute PE and are there ways to risk stratify patients? This is a critical appraisal article searching for the best available evidence, which there's not a whole lot of, for thrombolytic treatment for acute PE. So really kind of summarizing down this article, there's a few key points. There's three agents that have been approved for the treatment of QPE. Streptokinase, urokinase, RTPA are approved for the treatment of QPE. Now, tenecteplase is currently being studied for this. No single one has been shown superior, so the American College of Chest Physicians suggests RTPA because it can be given faster, 10 milligram bolus and then 90 milligrams over 2 hours. Point number two, hemodynamically unstable patients, give the thrombolytics unless there are significant bleeding concerns. Or if you have an interventional radiology procedure, or if you have aggressive thoracic surgeons as we do here, thrombectomy for the hemodynamically unstable patients. Point number three is for all the other patients, you need to risk stratify those patients, especially those without hemodynamic instability. So consider echo for RV dysfunction, check troponin values and BNP values. There are level 2B recommendations, so not great support for this to give thrombolytics for these patients in the absence of bleeding risks who have RV dysfunction. Now, limitations of this is a literature review only discussing recommendations on somewhat limited data. The application practice is really unstable patients need acute intervention, be it thrombolytics or interventional procedures or thrombectomy, and always consider the bleeding risks, contraindications to giving thrombolytics. Now, stable patients need to be risk stratified, and there's various studies that look at echo, BNP, troponin, but always kind of take this all into consideration for these patients.
There's a nice algorithm in the article. Basically, if they're stable, you probably aren't going to give it. If they're unstable, you probably will. And those with RV dysfunction, positive biomarkers, that's a tough call. Talk with your pulmonologist. Yeah. Next up is Garza et al., Improved Patient Survival Using a Modified Resuscitation Protocol for Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest in Circulation this past week. Now, the new American Heart Association CPR guidelines were released in 2005, and they encouraged eliminating early intubation and positive pressure ventilations, eliminating recommendations for immediate defibrillation and the use of stacked shocks, eliminating all unnecessary interruptions of chest compressions, and advocating chest compressions before and immediately after a single defibrillation shock and early administration of epi. That is the 2005 CPR guideline changes in a nutshell. The results of this study, this is the Kansas City EMS crew, and they made some changes to their arrest protocol, quote, including minimizing chest compression interruptions, increasing the ratio of compressions to ventilation, de-emphasizing or delaying intubation, and advocating chest compressions before initial countershock. Now, this sounds somewhat familiar to the 2005 guidelines, and I think they did a few novel things, and that would include a 50-2 compression to ventilation ratio versus the 30-2. They did 200 compressions prior to shocking, unless there was reliable CPR on scene. They did a single shock, then CPR, as per the current guidelines. They used manual defibrillators as much as possible, and they did not attempt intubation until after multiple rounds of CPR. So what they did, in essence, was to say, very often, once the EMS crew arrives, it's been over 5 minutes, and that patient is in a different phase of their arrest. They need some compressions before you give them a shock. That right. heart needs a little ATP to make it more happy before That's it's right. going to receive the electricity.
You got to prime the pump.
So that was kind of the concept. And so how did it turn out? Well, comparing cohorts prior to the change and those after this change in protocol in 2006, overall survival increased from 7.5% to 13.9%. Not bad. The odds ratio is 1.8. Those with an initial rhythm of ventricular fibrillation, survival increased from 37.8 to 59.6. Odds ratio 2.44, statistically significant. This is really impressive. And survival to discharge increased from 22.4% to 43.9. Odds ratio of 2.7. This is not bad. The limitations of this, it's a retrospective design that invites bias, of course, and it's unknown how well the new protocol was actually carried out by the EMS personnel. They were trained in this, had didactics, but did they actually do this? And there are a lot of things being studied simultaneously with this new protocol. So which one was important? I don't know. The application, I think it is, stay on the chest. Keep doing chest compressions. Do lots of them. And if there's any delay in defibrillation, you know, roughly 5 minutes, do compressions first before you try to shock them. So what I think this says is very encouraging that the 2005 AHA guidelines are on track, and there may be a few things that we could take away from this study, such as the different compression to ventilation ratio of 50 to 2, that would be potentially implemented in the 2010 release.
I agree. It certainly supports the new AHA CPR guidelines.
Get on that chest.
Yeah. Stay on it.
Bust them ribs.
That's right. Next up is Manini et al. Relationship between serum glycolate and falsely elevated lactate and severe ethylene glycol poisoning, published in Journal of Analytical Toxicology in April 2009. So the context of this study is that lactic acid can be falsely elevated in ethylene glycol poisoning due to a cross-reaction with glycolic acid. This study attempts to find a concentration-dependent relationship between the two. This is a case report of one patient with ethylene glycol ingestion. Serial blood samples were drawn, evaluated, and evaluated using the standard lactic acid spectrophotometry assay and gas chromatography for lactic acid, ethylene glycol, and glycolic acid. Using the GC results, or the gas chromatography results, the lactic acid was actually glycolic acid, and based on standard testing, the conversion factor was 2.58. Now, the limitations to this study is that this is one patient only, and the conversion factor is based on the widespread but not 100% spectrophotometry assay for measuring lactic acid. Now, the application in practice is, as when it comes to ethylene glycol, it's not lactic acid, baby. It's the glycolic acid that's creating the wide anion gap metabolic acidosis.
Hey, we should throw this into the mud piles. Maybe mud gut piles.
I like it. G mud pile.
G word.
It's straight up cold heart chilling.
Next up, Gigliano et al. Early versus delayed provisional epdefibitide in acute coronary syndromes, the early ACS trial.
Wasn't he the mayor of New York City?
Oh, I think it used to be Giuliani, but now it's Gigliano.
Yeah.
So this was this week, actually yesterday, came out in the New England Journal. The study question is, does early pre-procedure glycoprotein 2B3A improve outcome, or is it just as good to give it on an as-needed basis if a percutaneous coronary intervention, PCI, is performed? The results were, there were 9,406 patients that were randomized to early epdefibitide, two boluses of 180 micrograms per kilogram, and then an infusion, or epdefibitide as needed if PCI was performed. And they had the opportunity to get a rescue kit if they wanted to give a glycoprotein 2B3A inhibitor and they weren't sure whether they got study drug or didn't get study drug. The primary endpoint was, quote, a composite of death, MI, recurrent ischemia requiring urgent revascularization, or the occurrence of a thrombotic complication during PCI that required bolus therapy opposite to the initial study group assignment. They call this the thrombotic bailout.
I don't know. Is it coming from the part of the stimulus package or what?
At 96 hours. Anyway, that was the composite outcome. The secondary endpoint was a composite of death or MI within the first 30 days. Safety endpoints were bleeding and need for transfusion. The primary endpoint occurred in 9.3% of the early epdefibitide group and 10% of the provisional or PRN epdefibitide group, with an odds ratio of a blistering 0.92 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.8 to 1.06, p-value 0.23, meaning there's no difference.
That's right. Not significant. Confidence interval crosses one.
The early group had significantly more bleeding, however, and needed more transfusions. Now, the limitations, not a whole lot, because this was a big study, well done. Groups were well matched, including clopidogrel use, which was 90% in both groups. Importantly, Schering Plough and Millennium Pharmaceuticals provided funding, and the authors had scores of potential conflicts of interest, as in all cardiology articles. However, these are less troublesome because it's a negative study. The application at this point, glycoprotein 2B3A inhibitors really do not have a role for early ED administration. These are cath lab drugs for PCI, unless you want your patients to bleed. They're excellent for that.
Sure. You know, if they're having ischemia, you might as well go ahead and reduce their blood volume.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right.
ED stress test.
That's right. Next up is Mansour et al. Eye protection in orthopedic surgery, an in vitro study of various forms of eye protection and their effectiveness, published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery in May 2009. So the study questioned this is, what is the best way to protect your eyes while doing procedures? And are prescription glasses sufficient? So utilizing a simulation model, various eye protective devices were tested for conjunctival contamination while doing a femoral osteotomy. Now, none of these devices were perfect, but the disposable plastic glasses proved to be the best with only a 3% contamination rate. Modern prescription glasses. Now, we're not talking about your father's big wire-rimmed glasses or the ex-Laker Kurt Rambis's glasses that covered his entire face, had an 83% contamination rate. Pretty significant contamination on the conjunctiva.
What about contacts, Jim?
Contacts not helpful.
Okay, sorry.
Not helpful. But and neither were loops, for that matter. Yeah. Limitations of this article is that this is an orthopedic simulation with femoral osteotomies, and there's a lot of flex that get flying around if you do orthopedic surgery and cut into bone. However, the best abscesses are always under pressure and tend to squirt.
I love it.
And wound irrigation gets a little messy at times.
Pus must bust.
Exactly. So there is some application to what we do. Now, overall application of this article is really, can't you see? Prescription glasses are not protective glasses.
Word up.
And they don't protect your eyes. Put a face shield over them. And you need more protection for your eyes.
And we'd also like to say congrats to Alfred Mansour,
Jesse Evans.
And Ginny Halpern.
Yeah. Another venerable tone. But it really, though, it applies to what we do as well. So,
next up, yeah. Melendez et al. Serious adverse events during procedural sedation with ketamine, PEDS emergency care, in May 2009. The question of this study was, is IM versus IV ketamine associated with increased adverse events? Serious adverse events with ketamine are rare. That's why we use it. And these authors chose to use a case-control study design because several studies had looked at the use of ketamine looking for adverse events, but it's such a rare bird, you're not going to see it. So the case control study is actually the ideal study to look for this. And they found 102 cases of ketamine that had a complication. These were respiratory type complications. And they were mild to severe. And they matched 204 controls who did not have listed complications. 47% of the cases versus 27% of the controls received IM ketamine. Odds ratio 2.1, did not cross one, statistically significant. Of the 38 serious adverse events, 20 out of 38, that's 53%, received IM versus IV ketamine. Now, a serious adverse event was something that required fairly significant intervention. Positive pressure, CPAP, nasal trumpet, oral airway. I've just invented a new airway adjunct, Jim. Well,
you do use your mouth to play the trumpet, but
burr, 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 burr.
That's right.
Or intubation. So 53% of them were IM ketamine versus IV. Now, of the very rare cases of laryngospasm, get this, 20 out of 29, that's 69%, received IM versus IV ketamine. The odds ratio for that is 5.2. Now, of course, the limitations. There's inherent case control limits that are present in a retrospective chart review study. They also relied on computer search criteria to find their cases, which could have led to underreporting. They did not specify search terms to look for aspiration. Now, they may have searched for aspiration, but it wasn't spelled out in the paper, which would have been helpful. They did not define some terms such as apnea. And they didn't comment on end-tidal CO2 monitoring during these procedures. But the application is, I think, very clear, and this is the ideal study design to get to this. If you can give ketamine IV versus IM, you should. And if you can't, you need to be prepared to handle the complications, because the bad stuff, laryngospasm, apnea, need for intense intervention, is going to be more common if you're given an IM. Actually, more than twice as common than if you give it IV. So just get ready. Get your A game on.
Right. And kind of keep this paper in mind if you're unable to use IV ketamine in your emergency department, if you're limited by your hospital policies for this. So might consider taking this paper to your anesthesiologist or hospital board saying, hey, IV is safer than IM. Let's start using it. All right. Last up is Grand et al. Effective exposure to small pharmaceutical promotional items on treatment preferences, published in Archives of Internal Medicine, May 11, 2009. So really, how effective are those small little trinkets of pens and paper at changing attitudes about drugs? And really, do restrictive policy reduce this effect? This is a study that utilized implicit association testing and explicit attitudes to measure the effect of small trinkets on treatment choices of medical students. Third and fourth year students from the University of Miami and University of Pennsylvania were randomized to the brand group, which included Lipitor paraphernalia, or to the control group. And attitudes regarding Lipitor and Zocor were then tested using this implicit association test, which is actually really cool. And I recommend that you go to the Harvard website to look at it, because it will tell a little bit about yourself that you didn't realize. It's kind of interesting stuff.
Did you do it?
Yeah. Well, it's also included in this book, Blink, by Malcolm Gladwell. And I read Blink, I don't know, probably 2 years ago, and it talked about this implicit association testing. It's actually very...
Jim, I'm impressed.
It's utilized quite a bit by marketing and actually, you really get true attitudes, because it pairs targets, which would in this case would be the drugs, with the attributes, good or bad, and it measures how fast you are in selecting the attributes to the target.
So, dude, Jim, how are we going to use this for keeping up?
Unclear. Maybe we'll have to test people using keeping up as good.
Keeping up is good. Subliminal message.
Keeping up. So, and then also look to their explicit attitude testing. So the results of this is that the fourth-year students in Miami, if they were exposed to the Lipitor paraphernalia, they loved it. They loved some Lipitor. Whereas Penn students, the fourth-year students exposed to Lipitor, actually liked it less.
That's Penn, not P-E-N. That's P-E-N.
That's right. That's
U-Penn.
U-Penn.
Not like Lipitor Penn.
Exactly. Now, the third-year students had no difference. They're probably just happy to know what Lipitor and Zocor, what class of drugs they are.
That's right. Good antibiotics, aren't they?
That's right. They're great. Sorry, I know. I was a third-year medical student sometime as well. Now, the explicit attitude results, everyone loves Lipitor, but no effects from the branding exposure were seen. Now, interesting enough is that UPenn has a very strong school policy against persuasive pharmaceutical marketing, and maybe this is why the Penn fourth-year students essentially revolted against the branding. Now, the limitation is that there's two medical schools only that had people that can't write prescriptions. It really only measured attitudes and not behaviors. Now, the application to this is that really pharmaceutical companies shouldn't bother giving trinkets to Penn students because they're going to hate you for it. And really just send them all down to Miami because they love it.
Jim, how do you feel about Lipitor?
I take it myself. No, I'm just kidding. I own stock in Lipitor, so I love it. No, I'm just kidding. I do not. I'm fine. I don't have a right for this stuff anyway. So
I was down in the ED yesterday. I was like, anybody have a drug rep pen so I can take a picture of it for the podcast? I had to go to about 10 different people. So the policies have been instituted here at Vanderbilt, and they're obviously working, because Richard's waving his Coumadin pen at me right now. What, do you really need to market Coumadin? I mean, come on.
It's a great American poison. It's out there.
Jim is telling me something here.
Yeah, so we're going to go through some quick one-hitters over the articles.
First of all, I am not on the bandwagon of the nebulized epi and super mega high dose dexamethasone in kids with bronchiolitis, and I don't think that there's enough evidence for it yet.
Give clopidogrel. Just give it.
Absolutely. Who cares if they're going to cabbage? Next up, D2B ASAP. That's door to balloon as soon as possible.
Open the artery. That's what it takes. Now, thrombolytics for hemodynamically unstable patient, risk stratify the other patients.
Hemodynamically unstable PE patient.
Yes.
That's right. Next, stay on the chest when you're doing CPR. Do lots of compressions and do CPR prior to defibrillation if there's any delay.
All right. Ethylene glycol, that's not lactic acid causing the anion gap. That's glycolic acid, despite what your lab says.
Don't be fooled. It gives you a false positive for lactate. Next, at this point, glycoprotein 2B3A inhibitors do not have a role for early ED administration. Use them in the cath lab if you cath people.
Exactly. Now, protect your eyes. Don't rely on prescription glasses to do this. Wear something else.
Especially disposable little plastic glasses. Serious adverse events are much more common with IM versus IV ketamine. And if you want to use IM, get your A game on.
That's right. Get ready. And lastly, send your trinkets to the University of Miami because they seem to be impressionable students.
But not to UPenn.
Exactly.
You're going to waste your money.
That's right.
Don't forget to go to our website, keepingupinem.com. You can get your CME credit, a half credit hour for what you just did. All right. We hope you've enjoyed This Week in Journals. I hope you'll notify your friends. Tell them all.
That's right. And good luck out there. Keep on keeping up.
We want your implicit association testing.
Exactly. We'll have to talk to the Harvard people about seeing if we can set a test up for us.
Heck yeah. Maybe we can start using backmasking, subliminal messaging. Keeping up, keeping up.
I like it. Play it backwards on your iPod. That's right.
Bye.